Hello and welcome back to the Classics Podcast, and to this episode of Revision. In this mini bite-sized episode, you'll hear our host James Renshaw talking to two academics, Professor Lynette Mitchell of Exeter University and Dr. Roel Conandike of the University of Oxford. They'll be discussing Interpretation Question 1, Why Did the Greeks Win the Persian Wars? Here they discuss Xerxes' aims in his invasion of 480 to 479 BCE, and the extent to which the Greek world united against the Persians.
Let's come down to the 480s. And Darius dies in 486. We get a very brief mention in Herodotus of two rebellions that happen, one in the heartland, really, of the empire at Babylon, and then one in Egypt, which is a crucial economic part of the empire. Herodotus hardly mentions these revolts, apart from the fact that they happened and they have to be quelled. And then he comes on to talk about the preparations for the Greek invasion. So what's Xerxes doing with relation to Darius? Is it just one more push? It seems to be a bigger, we're told by Herodotus, it's a bigger, much bigger expedition. We know that Xerxes accompanies it and Darius doesn't. So I guess with relation to Babylon, to Egypt, and then to Greece, what's Xerxes' master plan here?
Right. So, I mean, the Persian king always has this obligation to ensure that all the areas that were once under control of the Persians have to remain so. So obviously any rebellion sort of prompts immediate action. But also Xerxes more generally profiles himself in his inscriptions as the continuity candidate. He was not the eldest son of Darius. He was not perhaps the most deserving of being the heir, except for the fact that his mother was Atossa, the daughter of Cyrus. So there is a very strong reason why Darius picked him, but Xerxes still felt that he needed to justify and legitimize the fact that he was the heir and not any of his at least three elder brothers, I think. And so there was a question there of like, okay, how do you justify that? Well, he presents himself as saying, everything my father did, I will finish it, right? I am going to complete these projects. I'm going to make sure that there is no perception of a break between my father and me. Everything is going to keep on going from great to even greater because I'm going to complete all of these separate projects. So these are construction projects. These are individual monuments where Xerxes would just add his own lines to what Darius had done. And they obviously include things like wars against Greeks because this is something that Darius had done that had been left undone. And so Xerxes must go and assert that whatever his father had tried to do, he would complete it. And so that's very likely to be one of the reasons why he felt compelled to go against Greece, and this time to go in full force to essentially establish that this was his great claim to legitimacy, as well as his attempt to finally achieve what his father had tried to achieve.
And it's the case, isn't it, that each new emperor sort of needs to have a new gain. I mean, our students will be doing the first five Roman emperors and they'll study Claudius conquering Britain because he needs to have something on his CV. And do you think there's an element of that going on for Xerxes?
Yeah, I mean, the Persian kings can easily be fit into this earlier Near Eastern tradition as well, where rulers who just come to the throne, they need to conquer something. This is a way of legitimizing themselves by proving that they are successful warriors and conquerors. And so there is pressure on every new king to go and, you know, lead the army somewhere. It doesn't really matter where it is, and go and fight someone and subdue them, or at least obtain some tokens of submission so that you can go home and say, look, I achieved this. These new peoples have been added to the empire, etc. Now, this starts after Xerxes. It starts to become a less important driver for Persian action, or at least they stop doing this. Essentially, they stop trying to expand the empire further. But at least until Xerxes, we can see every successive Persian king tries to lead these huge campaigns against enemies further and further afield. And especially early in the reign, that very clearly has a sort of legitimizing function.
Okay, well, thank you. That's really useful to think about Xerxes' perspective there. So, Lynette, if we come across to you, we hear, well, people who don't know much about the Persian Wars might think it's the Greeks against the Persians. But we need to be really careful about this, don't we? Because there's probably more Greeks fighting on the Persian side. And as we've already said, I think there are only 31 states named on the serpent column. So to what extent does the Greek world unite to combat the Persians here?
It's a very mixed picture. There are some Greek states who do. Athens and Sparta, of course, and we've already talked about Corinth and various other places, but then there are some really notable exceptions. And Argos, for example, doesn't take part at all. And Delphi seems to be determined that Xerxes must win. And so discourages people like the Cretans from taking part. So it isn't a very united Greek world. There are some people who think that actually that it may not be a bad thing. And there are some people who get pushed into it. The Thessalians seem to originally to have thought that they were prepared to be part of the resistance effort. But once the Greeks decided, the rest of the Greeks who joined together in a council and created the Hellenic League against the Persians, once they decided that they couldn't defend the Thessalians, the Thessalians simply went over to the other side. And of course, there's always the story that it becomes notorious about the Thebans, who are said to have Medized in relation to the campaign at Thermopylae. So it's one of the things that the Greeks don't do is unite. However, they have a story of uniting. And again, it's part of their, it's one of the counter narratives that they want to tell is that they did unite against the Persians, but the actual fact of it was that it was very fragmented and made it all the more surprising that they actually did win, because they were so fragmented and there were so few Greek states who were actually prepared to put themselves on the line and join this resistance movement.
I think, isn't there a story in Herodotus that he says that the Phocians only joined the loyalist Greek side in the Hellenic League because the Thessalians went the other way? And it was much more about one-upmanship in the Greek world in terms of who you sided with. And maybe Argos, obviously a bitter rival of Sparta, and probably thinks, you know what, if the Persians come in, we can work with them quite nicely and we can be top dog in the Peloponnese. So is there something like that going on quite a lot?
Oh, absolutely, because we're back to this question of competition, and the tension between Argos and Sparta in the Peloponnese is one of very long standing, and it's an issue that continues on even after the Persian Wars. That it's interesting that the Argives never get accused really of Medizing in the way that the Thebans do. And perhaps because they didn't actively do anything, they just didn't do anything. They just didn't take part. But it's a little bit like Delphi. Delphi clearly thinks that if they advised against the Greeks in the sense that they assume that the Persians will win, that actually that will benefit them in the long run, because then presumably they think that the Persians will then be favourable to them when the inevitable Persian victory happens. But of course it doesn't. And then they have to excuse the fact that they went the other way, that they sort of in the competition, you know, choosing the side, they chose the wrong side. And so they have to then wiggle their way out of that one.
So I think what's important then is that this idea that Herodotus wants us to think about is it's all about ideology and fighting for freedom and Greekness. We should be really skeptical of, shouldn't we? Because actually it's all about what's going to be best for my community. And if having Persian overlordship is what's going to be best, then the Greeks will go for it, or Greek cities will go for that. Is that correct?
It is, but it is still true that the Greeks, after Plataea, they set up an altar at Plataea to say that this was all about Greek freedom. This was common to Hellas, and that, you know, we were fighting for freedom. So it's not just Herodotus. Herodotus is just replaying a rhetoric which has already been talked about, and it becomes a way very quickly that the Greeks want to present this war. So Herodotus actually elaborates it. And what's really interesting about Herodotus is that he does have all this talk of freedom and fighting for freedom, but he also shows us that it wasn't like that. And he doesn't go out of his way to make that point, but he makes it very clear that the Argives aren't taking part, and that Gelon in Syracuse is just not really interested unless he gets to run the show and things like that. So that's what, in a sense, makes Herodotus so interesting and so much fun on all of this, is that he's aware of these two different narratives and he's prepared to play with both of them and, you know, show that there is a tension that's going on there. I mean, that's part of Herodotus' skill, in fact, that he's able to he's able to have these two separate and contradictory narratives running, but still as part of his storytelling about the war altogether.
Make sure you follow the Classics podcast on Spotify so that you'll be the first to hear about each new episode. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and make sure you follow us on Instagram at The Classical Pod. For bonus materials, check out our website, classicalassociation.org/podcast.